So I'm very happy to introduce my friend and collaborator, Andrea Nanamot, who will speak about invariant use measures and propagation of randomness for non-net specific patients.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Bjorn. Thank you to the organizers, especially Nina and Roland, for the invitation. And let me first, besides thanking for the invitation, apologize to all the people that I'm not going to mention that I should mention, but it's hard to do justice to everybody who has built this, and also to the physicists, because I'm not a physicist, and so probably if the physicist asks me a question, I won't know the answer. So. All right, so let me start by actually talking a little bit. So they asked me to sort of do a little bit of a survey of like, sort of like what is it known for dispersive field is on sort of what I call gives measures of sort of the fields. But so let me start by saying, okay, so the first thing that I want to do is to sort of do a little bit of a review of Burgen's ideas, who started this, say in the context of the Gibbs measure for 2D periodic MLS. And then it's kind of like I want to discuss a little bit the work that we did more recently with Yu Deng and Heijian Yue that somehow allow us to extend these results for in 2D for any odd power. And then sort of like try to develop a theory for the dispersive context that is kind of like gives the local robustness for any dimension and any power, nonlinearity, say for Schrodinger, in what we call the full subcritical range, which is kind of like sort of these black box theories of robustness that were obtained in the stochastic, in the singular stochastic PDE by Martin and related structures. And I will talk a little bit about normalizations later, because we don't do that. And then in passing, I'm going to mention, sorry about Bjorn, because I'm very fond of this paper with Bjorn and Heijian and Yuden, in which we did the what we call the hyperbolic FI43, which is essentially the invariance of the 3D Gibbs measures under the flow of the cubic sort of nonlinear wave equation. And I won't have time to sort of like say much about this, so but I want to mention a couple of things. So the first two slides are, I learned them from Bjorn because I always start very high, and so it's like he tells me to start very low. So this, the first two slides are from him. So everybody knows, let's just set some ideas that it is sort of like basic ODEs. It has some physical systems with some forcing acting on it. So you have a potential energy with some nonlinear interactions. Then you can actually, from there, you can construct the Hamiltonian ODE. Or if you have some fluctuations of random forces, you can actually construct a Langevin SDE. And the point is that no matter which of these two ways you go, for both of them, we essentially obtain essentially the same Gibbs measures. Gibbs measure, which you can prove that is invariant, so in the context of Hamiltonian ODEs because of the conservation of Hamiltonian and Liouville theorem, and in the context of SDEs, is you have to use ITO, but essentially you can prove that. And so, of course, having this in mind, we go to infinite dimensions. And so I don't see anything, so I want to look here. So we start with a field. So I'm going to always to be in the periodic case. P here is going to be always odd, bigger or equal than 3. And we have here like an energy functional, which I call H of phi, which is given by sort of the mass, the gradient, the mass, the gradient, and our potential energy now is going to be phi to the p plus 1. So p plus 1 is always even. And this is kind of like a positive definite functional, okay? So formally, to this, taking into account what we just said for ODEs, you can associate, you know, formally, sort of like a Gibbs measure. The way that is written is total nonsense because it's kind of like all these three terms don't make any sense, but there is a way of constructing. So my starting point is I'm going to assume that the measure is given to me, and what we're trying to understand is what are the dynamics under the flows of this measure under the flows. And so in the picture that we just saw, so when we go into the Hamiltonian ODE side, we can go with complex value fields, which will give you sort of the nonlinear Schrödinger equation. You can go with real value fields, which is a real Hamiltonian, which will give you the nonlinear wave equation. That side. And on the other side, you get the stochastic heat equation. And so it's the same measure, but you can the dynamics are different depending which flows you take. So the case of the heat is very well understood. So my talk is about the A and B. Okay, so let me just go on this table, which we have actually in the paper of the wave with Bjorn, which is a little bit the history of what happened with all of these things. So the first column has the measure in dimensions 1, 2, 3, and above. So that is about the existence, so the construction of the measure. The second one is about the second, the third, so heat wave of Schrödinger is about the dynamics. And so the story starts, I think, with Nelson in the 60s, in which the measure he constructed, I guess, the measure in dimension 1 and 2. And then it continues sort of in the 73 with Gleeman Jaffe, who constructed in 3D the measure, but only when p is 3. So in dimensions 1 and 2, you can construct it for any p odd, bigger or equal than 3. And in dimensions 3, only when p is 3. And then you have in the 80s the results of Einsman and Frohlich, who proved that you have sort of marginal triviality in dimensions bigger or equal than 5. And then recently in 2019, this is Einsman and Dumine-Lcoupe, who prove also marginal triviality for in dimensions 4. This is for the cubic, so it's phi 4-4. And so, how about the dynamics? So, the story starts with the wave. And starts with a Freelander in 85, who proved that for any power in dimension 1, the measure remains invariant. So you have a global flow, so you have to have a global solution. So you have a global solution, and then for data that is in the that has Gibbsian data, that you're in the support of the measure, and he proved that you have invariance. Then it follows by Iwata in 87, who proved the same thing in dimensions 1 for the heat. And then essentially nothing happened for about 10 years until 1994, in which Burgin proved that under the flow of the NLS for any odd power nonlinearity, as long as you are defocusing, you have also the invariance of the measure for NLS. And it's actually a little bit surprising that the way in which things happen, because they happen first in the dispersive context and then in the sort of in the heat context, at least in dimensions 2. So the next results came, and this is a seminal paper of Burgin, very important paper in 1996, that in 2D for the cubic NLS defocusing, he proved that indeed the measure is also invariant. Okay, and we're going to talk about this is the paper that I want to stop a little bit about. And then this is in his Park City lecture notes. He proved also for the wave equation any power that you are invariant. So here is for any p, for the wave is for any p, but in for Schrödinger is only for p equals to 3. Okay. And then after that, what happened took essentially a few more years until 2003, which Taprato-Debusch proved that in 2D, for the heat equation and any power, you also have the invariance of the measure under the flow. And essentially, we will talk about this. There is a sort of a connection between the method, this linear nonlinear decompositions that Burgin and Taprato-Debusch used, but there's some differences. And then nothing happened for about 10 years until the work of Martin Heer, who was the breakthrough in dimension 3 that allowed to prove that, okay, you have the local theory, and then it's also the paper of Martin Heer with Matesky and Murray with Weber for the global part, in which you essentially have here that you have also the invariance of the Gibbs measure under the flow of the cubic, say, stochastic heat. Okay, in 3D. And then after that, it took a few years, but essentially with Yu Deng and He Tianyue, we sort of we took this question in 2D, in which the measure exists for any p, so why p equals to 3? Why not quintic? And say something like the quintic NLS is very natural because it shows up when When you do sort of Bose-Einstein condensates and you take ternary collisions, the equation that you see is the quintic. Is, you know, if you do binary collision, you see the cubic, but if you do ternary, you see the quintic. So it's relevant. And so we retook that question, and sort of we were able to prove, and this is one of the things I'm going to talk about, that actually for any p odd, you have also the invariance of the measure. Okay. And then after that, in 2022, with Bjorn, is we prove that in dimension three and p equals to three for the cubic nonlinear wave equation, the measure is also invariant. And this is what we call, or I don't know who calls it, the hyperbolic phi-4-3. Maybe is that yours? So I don't know who put this name. Okay. All right. So, and that came in 2022 and 2022. So, this is essentially the picture that took take us essentially from 1960 all the way to 2022. And this is what is known. This is like the global picture of at least what I know about these PP plus 1D models in the periodic case. And there is three different flows. Okay, so that this doesn't mean that you cannot build Gibbs measures for other for other equations, right? I mean, if you have a Hamiltonian equation, you can always build one, but let's just stick to these ones. Okay. All right, so let me actually set up some ideas. So we take Schrödinger and I take it. Yes. Yes, of course.
Here you the bottom two lines you call red.
Oh, because then here you have marginal triviality. There's only the Gaussian measure that is you have. So you can ask dynamical questions, but I'm just sticking to the Gibbs measure. So yes, you could ask some dynamical questions, but I'm not going there. Yes, thank you. Thank you.
You know, for
Yes.
physicists, it would be maybe complicated to prove that it converges when you start from some initial condition that it converges to this measure. And when you have the measure, the Fokker-Planck equation not evolve this measure. So, what is the problem? Why is it a problem for you?
The problem is that the first thing that you need to prove is that for data that is in support of these measures and in dimensions two and larger, the data are distributions that are very rough, that you have a solution at all, the local solution almost surely. Probability that if I take, say, data in the support of this measure, then you have a solution for some finite time. Then is the question, okay, for that finite dimensional system, can you make it global? Then how do you go from there to the infinite dimensional solution? And then after that, you actually prove that the finite dimensional measures that are associated to the finite dimensional Hamiltonian converge weakly to the measure.
So can I ask, what about in infinite volume in G post?
We're getting some work on that, but I'm not talking about it anymore. There is some work done, and I guess Björn with Gilles Patilani, they did it for the wave, the analog of what Burgen did for Schrödinger, correct?
Schrödinger and people apply.
Oh, so you stay in Schrödinger. So Burgen did it for p equals to 3 on the line, and Björn and Staffilani, Brinkmann Staffilani, did it for p bigger or equal than 5. Okay, still what is Schrödinger. Yeah, okay. I don't know anymore about this. But I mean, for heat, of course, by way of Schrödinger is very different. Binary. All right, so here we have the Schrödinger equation, and this is the defocusing equation. And this is important. So the Hamiltonian here is so the mass, I mean, the L2 norm and the Hamiltonian are conserved quantities of time. So these are constants of time. And the Hamiltonian is positive definite, so you have a sign. And so this equation you can actually do it by hand by rescaling your variables, your x and t when you are on RD. But if not, you can heuristically you can also do it by understanding scaling is about how the high frequencies of your solution interact. When you have two high frequencies that interact and give you a high frequency, then from those heuristics you can also guess what your deterministic scaling is, which for the equation, the deterministic scaling is the dimension over 2 minus 2 over p minus 1. So let's stick with the, say, dimension is 2 and p is 3. In the cubic case, in two dimensions, the deterministic scaling is L2. Okay? Now, what is amazing is that the biggest theorem there is deterministically about this Schrödinger equation on the torus is that provided this number is non-negative, and provided that you take data that is strictly bigger than that, so that your data has to be strictly bigger than this. So if you are in cubic 2D, the data has to be strictly bigger than zero. You cannot take that in L2. Then the equation is locally well posed. But nobody knows. Amazing, but nobody knows if you take data in L2, whether this equation has deterministically any local solutions. Okay, but can you speak up?
Sorry, I think there is something decent L2 data.
Yeah, that is, but it's not quite this. It's a little bit
now more straightforward.
The setting of Sebastian Ferrer and the parameter,
yes,
but it's not quite the full result. I heard that talk. That talk later, but it's not quite the full result. Yeah, I mean they have something, but it's not the full result. So, as far as I understand, and you have some ill-posedness when S is strictly less than the critical one, and this is okay, some work. So anyway, so we are going to be interested in random data because we are going to be studying the Gibbs measure. So we start with sort of like a random variable, which is formally given, is the law of which is formally given by a Gaussian measure. And so here, these are Gaussians. And here I take a power alpha, say alpha. This is important that you remember because it's going to appear later. So alpha is say S, what is it? I with the D. So plus dimension over 2, okay, or S is the same as alpha minus dimension over 2. So so you take random data in this fashion. So these are IID. You can take, let's say you take Gaussian random IID random variables. And so when alpha is 1, this is very special because this corresponds to sort of the statistical ensemble of a Gibbs measure. Okay, at least in dimensions 1 and 2, we can talk about dimensions 3 later. And what I want to point out now here is that, you see, if you are in dimensions 1 and alpha is 1, then your measure is going to be, so the regularity of the measure, which is given by the Gaussian one, is actually supported on functions which lie in h half minus. But if you're in dimensions 2 or 3, where the measure exists, then your Gaussian part, your Gaussian measure is going to be supported on distributions, which in 2 dimensions are below L2, and in dimension 3, they are below h minus a half. So these are subset spaces, so they are very, very rough. And so this is one serious problem, okay? Remember that I said that deterministically the in L2 for the cubic equation is L2 is the critical deterministically. So here already we are in the supercritical regime for solutions of the cubic equation in 2D. So in principle, we don't expect, I said, you expect deterministically, you expect ill-posedness. Okay, and okay. So what is it that we were interested in? So the questions that we were interested in is in the study, you start with this random initial data that is distributed according to some canonical law like the Gaussian, and suppose that you have first independent Fourier coefficients. This happens at least in dimensions 2. And we want to understand how this random structure gets transported under the flow of the dispersive PDE. So what happens, you feed in, you have an equation that is deterministic, you have data that is random, you feed in this into the nonlinear flow, and you want to see what happens. In other words, how is this data transported under this flow? What is the optimal regime where solutions exist and are unique, almost surely, at least locally in time? Can you describe the solution in terms of the random structure? In other words, not just do they exist, but can you give me a description of how do they look like? I mean, the theory of regularity structure, that's what regularity structures does. They give you a description, a very precise description of the solution. We are asking the same question, at least for short times. And if there is formally, at least formally defined, if there is a Gibbs measure associated to this, can we justify the invariance? Can we prove that they are invariant? Which will come after we prove that we have global solutions. Okay, so let me actually talk a little bit about what is for us the threshold. So this goes to the first question. What is the optimal regime in which solutions are be expected to exist when you take random data for local time? And so the first thing that we understood is that you see the deterministic scaling has nothing to do with this problem, because the deterministic scaling, when you do it, does not see the central limit theorem, right? So it doesn't see anything probabilistically. So it shouldn't be the true threshold. And so to find the true threshold, we actually essentially will do the same calculation that you will do in the deterministic case, but instead of putting a one here, we put the Gaussian. So suppose that you take data, so you take a random variable, so they are all supported at the same frequency. They are all sort of like a n to the minus. This I had here before a k to the alpha. Now they're all k is like n, so that comes out here as n to the minus alpha. Then you have your random variables, and that's the Fourier series. So you take data like this. And then you take the linear evolution of that. So the semi group for Schrodinger is e to the I t Laplacian. On the Fourier side, you will have mod e to the I t mod k squared. And essentially, this is going to have almost surely unit size in HS, the same S and alpha related in the same way. And so what is it that you want? If you're going to try to prove local well-posedness, okay, the linear evolution is going to be well-defined locally in time, obviously. But what you want is that if you take, say, the second iterate, so in other words, you take the you put on the right-hand side the linear evolution, say the cubic one. No, I put anything, any power. So this is the linear evolution. So if this is going to be locally well-posed, what it should happen is that for fixed time, and say fixed n, n is fixed here, then the second iterate should remain in the same space you started with. So if you start in HS, you expect that the second iterate, this, should stay in the same space. So let's try to find out when does it stay in the same space, okay? So when does it stay in the same space? So, okay, we are working on the Fourier side because this is the best thing for NLS and dispersive PD. You take the Fourier transform, you have a cubic P power. So you're taking the Fourier transform of a product, you get a convolution. So you write down what that is. And essentially, okay, so in this picture, so the n to the minus P alpha is because you take P powers of this n. So you get n to the minus P alpha. And then you get here, which I call it a base tensor, this is deterministic, you get here the characteristic function of this set. So what is this set? This set is deterministic, it's just telling you that you took the Fourier transform of a multilinear expression, of a p power of u. So the first one, the first equation tells you that it's a convolution, and the second one comes, this is what we call the resonant equation, comes because you know you have the linear evolution of that, and you took a Fourier transform, so then you have this quadratic relationship among the frequencies of each of the u's. You have that k1 squared minus, so the plus minus is because in Schrodinger, you have solutions and complex values, so every time that you see, so p minus 1 is even, so this is a u times a u bar, right? So divided by 2. So you have a quadratic equation. Now, because you see a quadratic equation here, the first thing that you understand is that something that is non-trivial that has to do with counting integer lattice points enters. Something that is beyond just a geometric problem or a dimension counting. And so let me explain that. So if I want to understand what's the size of this Fourier coefficient, then by the large deviation estimate, you know, material large deviation estimate, you know that then this in absolute value is controlled by the little L2 norm of this coefficient. So, but the little L2 value of this coefficient is simply the cardinality of this set to the power 1/2. That's the 1/2 from the central limit theorem, okay? So if you had here 1, 1, 1, 1, which is the deterministic case, you wouldn't have this 1/2, and this same calculation will recover the deterministic scaling. Okay, so now we're doing it probabilistically, right? So let me tell you where this number, why is it that the cardinality of this set is this number in blue, which is nd times p minus 2 plus d minus 2 plus epsilon. Well, the reason is because you need to count how many integer lattice points you have, say, in the quadratic equation. So what you do, okay, k is fixed, omega is some constant that is fixed. And so what you do is you count to full dimension, say, k2 through kp. So that gives you to full dimension, that gives you n to the dimension times p minus 2. So that's this number. That's just dimension counting. And then you have to, now you have an equation that essentially reads k1 squared equals to a constant. So what do? You count the last d minus 2 coordinates. So you are in zd, right? K is an integer in zd. You count the last d minus 2 coordinates to full dimension. That gives you n to the d minus 2. And then essentially what you have left is the equation of a circle. You have the first two coordinates of k1. So you have k1 in x and k1 in y that are satisfying the equation of a circle. And this is where the number theory comes in, because now you have to use a sphere, the sphere counting estimate that tells you essentially that the number of integer lattice points that lie on this circle is like n to the epsilon. It's smaller than n to the epsilon, and that's where this plus comes in. Okay, and that sphere counting, which you can do with higher dimensions, and it's like n to the epsilon times n to the d minus 2, comes, you know, it's related to this
divisor estimates and so on.
So big omega is just a constant. Okay, so you can call it omega. There is a little bit of I'm ignoring the time variable. So there is a little bit of fuzziness here that has to do with time, and I'm ignoring it. So just think of this, ignore it. Zero. So think of omega for a second to be like zero.
We're like one. Okay. So I mean there is an integration that has to do with time in omega that I'm not going for this. Yeah. There is a log there lost that I'm not talking about. But you know, there's already another log loss. So I don't have my plot. Another n to the epsilon here. So it's definitely there is an integral of 1/(ω) that gives you another log of n, which I'm not dealing with it. So I'm not taking time into account. Time is short. We can ignore it. So now you ask the question. Okay, now you have this bound, and as I said, if instead of Gaussians you have one, then that would be essentially the deterministic scaling. And so now you say, when is this bounded in the Sobolev space? And the answer is if and only if the S that you have, that S, is strictly bigger than -1/(p-1). So the independent of the dimension, right, for any power p, in order to expect, I mean, the best that you, oops, what happened? The best that you can expect in local well-posedness is to reach the threshold of -1/(p-1). And that's the best. That doesn't mean that you will reach it, but that's the best that you can expect for Schrodinger. And our result, actually, we actually prove it. We prove that you can reach it. I mean, that's actually one of the things I'm going to talk about. And so you can do the similar type of calculations for other equations. So you can actually repeat this for the stochastic heat equation. And the number that you get in this probabilistic scaling notion for the heat is exactly the same as the one that you obtain and you Martin computed, which when p, say, is 3 for the cubic equation, gives you -1, okay, which is what you expect. And in the case of the wave, it gives you, when p is 3, it gives you -3/4. So the wave is kind of like in between Schrodinger and heat. So in heat you have -1, in Schrodinger you have -1/2, and in the wave you will have -3/4, say for p equals to 3, okay? And for other p's, okay. So somehow this is in between. And that's actually consistent with the fact that for Schrodinger you will never have any regularization, so that your Duhamel, so the probability doesn't give you any regularization. A wave gives you one derivative, essentially, and heat gives you 2, but Schrodinger gives you 0. Okay, so that's actually a little bit coherent. So, okay, so as I said, this is just a guiding principle. That doesn't mean that you will always reach it.
And in many cases, you cannot. The wave is one of them, because you have problems with not just high into high interactions. You have also problems when two waves that are at a high frequency interact and give you a low frequency, in which case you cannot, you have problems. And of course, these calculations depend on the global geometry and on the particular dispersive relation or whatever you have there. Okay. Okay. Any questions? All right. So let me talk about Burgin. And so, of course, this is what I was telling you before. Before you start with some finite dimensional approximation to your equation, and because we are doing things on Fourier, n here is a dyadic number. So n is something, is a frequency. So it's kind of like something that is in here. Okay. And it seems if you are used to the parabolic case, what you should think is that n is like your 1 over epsilon. When you do the modifications of your equation with sort of approximations to the identity, the 1 over epsilon that you see in the parabolic case is the same as the n. Okay. So then you take, so what is it that, what is this is the meaning? You take your data, you truncate it up to frequencies no larger than n, and you can take a sharp cutoff or a smooth cutoff, it doesn't matter here. And then un is just the solution of this equation with this data. Okay, and we take the weak order of this, which is the usual renormalization that you do, where you have infinite mass here, so you need to somehow subtract this term from here. Otherwise, you cannot make sense of the nonlinearity, right? The nonlinearity doesn't make any sense as a distribution unless you renormalize it properly. So now, so local well-posedness means whatever you think it means. It means that somehow outside some set, there is a small time and some small set, probability very small, such that if omega is outside that set, then the sequence of solutions here, un, will converge to a solution u in the continuous functions with values in hs minus, which is where the random data is, where f omega. So you see the solution and the data is in the same space. Hs minus. Sorry, here you're going to be confused because I didn't put the alpha. If you put alpha, then the S is the alpha. If you don't put the alpha, because I'm going to talk about Burgin, I'm in 2D for the cubic. So for the measure, the alpha is 1. So this S should be 0, 0 minus. Okay. But if you put alpha, then the S is like that. Okay, and so this is well defined. The nonlinearity is well defined in the limit in the sense of distributions, and the u solves the equation in the sense of distribution. So this is what you expect this should be. So what is that Burgin did? So he considered the cubic equation in 2D, and he considered the Gibbs measure. And the Gibbs measure in 2D, as I told you, is supported just below L2. So he supported the Gibbs measure is supported in 0 minus. The deterministic scaling is L2. So this is super critical with respect to the deterministic scaling, but it's actually subcritical with respect to the probabilistic scaling, which in the cubic case is minus a half. Okay. So what happens is that this is not a perturbation problem. If you want to solve this equation by a fixed point argument, you have to do a fixed point argument in a space which is super critical where you cannot prove it. It's not a per you cannot do a fixed point argument in 0 minus below L2. Okay, it's not going to, you're never going to be able to close your estimates. So what he does this linear nonlinear decomposition, which some of you know also as what Dapprata-Dibouche did, in which you sort of like separate the linear evolution of the random, which is the roughest term, but it's random. You know precisely the random structure of that term, and it's the worst. You separate it, and then you solve for you find the difference equation. You solve V solves the equation for u minus that. You find the equation for that, and then you try to solve by a fixed point argument. You try to find V in a smoother space than L2. So in other words, you do a fixed point argument for V in some subtle space of regularity strictly bigger than 0. And so when you do that, this is the difference equation. In order to prove that, this is like the cubic one, you have to understand the interactions of things that are linear evolutions against themselves. So say you have three randoms against, random, random, random. You have three deterministic one, you treat V as a determinist. It's not deterministic, but you treat it as deterministic. So you have three qubits, and then you have interactions of both. And so what happens is that when everything is random, you can actually, what saves you is exactly that you can use large deviation estimates, like we did in the scaling. When everything is deterministic, because you are trying to put it above L2, you have you use the deterministic local theory that you already know, so you have the estimates for when everything is B. And the problem that you have is when you have a combination of these things. Because when you have a combination of these things, then you are in trouble. You cannot do the large deviation estimates. And so the three main ingredients here is, okay, you have multilinear large deviations. We talked about that. You have to use a little bit of analytic number theory, this integer lattice counting estimates. We talk about that in the context of the scaling. But there's actually one of the most important ideas in Bourguin. It's not just this linear nonlinear decomposition. It's this idea that when you have no gain of regularity from your Duhamel, how are you going to exploit randomness? And the answer to that is via these random matrix estimates, or these TP star arguments that he does, which is just a random matrix estimate. And that's actually, for me, that's the most important idea in this work, is that you cannot prove anything for Schrodinger unless somehow you exploit randomness using these random matrix estimates. Okay, so let me give you an example of what that means. So if you have something, so as I said, you have to do estimates with random, deterministic, all mixtures, and the frequencies, you have to take large frequency or small frequency, all possible frequencies everywhere. So suppose that you have one case, this one, which is DRR. So you have deterministic random non-random. Suppose the deterministic function, the V, is in a high frequency and the other two are in a low frequency. So what does it mean that they are in a low frequency? It means that the decay that you have here is useless because this could be one. So that means that this doesn't help you. And you need to control this in L2. Now, you know nothing about the independence between this and that. So you cannot use any large deviation estimates to do this, to compute this. Helder doesn't work because, as I said, you don't have any decay. So, in other words, you have no way to sort of compensate or to offset the growth that you get from the counting estimates of this set. So, if this were large, you could offset the number that you get here. When these are low, there is nothing you can do. So, the correct way to exploit this independence somehow, because you do have some independence, and you have no smoothing whatsoever, is to use this. What he does is he considers this matrix, which I call G, or sigma KK1, which is defined as, okay, N2 and N3 are the size of the frequencies of K2, K3. And then you have the sum as above with the two Gaussians, okay? Forget the V. And you think of this expression as being this matrix being applied to the vector V in K1. And now what you want to do is you want to understand the operator norm, the L2 operator norm of this matrix. And the way to do so is by what we call a TT star argument. You look at the operator, the matrix, and you look at the adjoint of this matrix. And then the L2 operator norm of G is the same as the square root of the operator norm of GG star. Now, when you do GG star, you're going to double the number of Gaussians. You're going to have to be very careful with what is independent, what is not. So the proof of this is very long, several pages. There's a lot of analysis you have to do, box localizations. It's quite complicated. But in the end, he gets the right decay for this object to close the estimate. Without this, you are dead in the water. You cannot do anything. In the wave case, this doesn't happen. You can get away with streakers, essentially, and sort of like, you know, counting estimates that come from geometry and multilinear large deviation estimates. You don't really need to bring this TT star argument into play. But for Schrodinger, you absolutely need to, okay? And this is actually something that is very important. And I want to emphasize this because it's not just about the ansatz that is linear, nonlinear. It's not just about that. Bourguin's seminal idea is to bring in
this random matrix estimate to bear to compensate for the fact that Schrödinger has no smoothing whatsoever. All right, so after you have proved the local well process with this, there is something that is called Burgin's globalization argument that I'm not going to go through that, but I put the slide so that if you want to read it afterwards, because you're going to have the slides, you can read it on your own. And essentially, this is what the question that you asked me is, how do you do the whole procedure? And so it's explained here step by step. And let me just not say anything because I'm already like super behind. But you know, this is pretty well understood how to do it. Once you have the local well, the probabilistic local well process, there is this argument that tells you, okay, how do you get the global well postness for the app for the finite dimensional approximation and also for the solution itself. And it's not obvious, okay? To go for the finite dimensional approximation from local to global, you need to exploit the fact that the finite dimensional approximation is also Hamiltonian. So if you look at the Gibbs measure for that, then that's invariant. And you use that invariance of the finite dimensional one as a conservation law to extend the local solution of the finite dimensional approximation to a global one. And then you cannot compare the infinite dimensional solution with the finite dimensional solution globally because you know nothing about U. So there is a very intricate and delicate argument with an intermediate system, which is the infinite equation with finite dimensional data. And you have to do this game, which is kind of like this commutator and stability arguments and their small perturbations that allow you to walk the infinite solution next to the finite solution one time step at a time. Okay, so it's not trivial, but it's understood. So in the end, you get that the solutions of the infinite dimensional system are almost surely global. And once you have that, you prove the invariance of the infinite dimensional measure. I say that's the icing in the cake. You prove it at the very end. Okay, so then let me ask this question. I mean, okay, so what if you are not interested in the Gibbs measure? So Burgin, this is what happened. This is what was non-deterministically. This is what Burgin did. He went below L2 with his method to prove the local well process here. But we know that even for the cubic equation, the probabilistic scaling is minus a half. So what happens is we go below the support of the Gibbs measure, say in 2D. What happens is that this method doesn't work anymore. It breaks down, okay? In other words, Burgin's method fails as soon as you leave the support of the measure. As soon as you become rougher, you're dead, okay? And the reason is because if you do this nonlinear decomposition, say you need to put this V, or like in this case, right? You need to put this V in a space where you know your deterministic theory. So, but the problem is that no matter what, if you start below this, so Burgin, what he did with the TT star is gain enough regularity to go from below L2 to above L2. But if I start here, I need to gain all of this regularity. I need to somehow put this V above L2 when I start below, much lower than this. And so, and what happens is that when you do this, there is no way. This V is always below L2. You can never put it above L2. There's no way of closing, okay? And the same problem happens when you take any power bigger than 3. When you take powers bigger than, V or equal than 5, and you stay with the two dimension, and you say, why did Burgin only prove it for the cubic when on the wave he could prove it for any power? It's the same problem. It's because if you take power 5, let's suppose that power is 5, so the quintic equation in 2D has deterministic scaling at h 1/2. So if I start sort of like with random data, say, in the support of the Gibbs measure corresponding to power 5, I will be just below L2. And what that means is that now, instead of going from below L2 to a little bit above L2, which is the cubic case, you have to go from below L2, which is from 0 minus, all the way above h1/2. So you have to gain not a little bit of regularity, you have to gain a lot of regularity. And if p is bigger than 5, then you have to actually go from 0 minus all the way here, all the way to above 1 minus 2 over p minus 1. So how do you do that? I mean, you know, how do you do that? So this doesn't work. Okay, and so you cannot actually do this using just the regularity of the V. You have to really understand the random structure. You have to stop pretending that V is deterministic, and you really have to get your hands dirty and understand the random structure of this remainder. Okay, and so the first question that you do is where this bad regularity comes from, and this is similar to what happened in the heat. The bad regularity comes from the interactions when you have high frequencies in the linear evolution of random and low frequencies in the other terms. Here I just wrote something cubic. So it's the same kind of problem that you have in the heat, except, okay, in the heat you have problems when you have a quadratic term on the noise and then the law. So you have like z squared times u, but here, okay, here you have it linear in here. But it's again, high, low into high interactions. The problem is that in the paracontrol theory, for example, of Gobinelli, it's enough to remove this term once, which is essentially, this term is like a paraproduct. And once you have changed your ansatz, in the sense that you do, okay, you do linear evolution of random, you separate this term, then immediately what remains becomes regular, and you can close, thanks to the fact that the heat operator gains you two derivatives. In Schrödinger, this never happens. It doesn't matter. I remove this, I stay below it too. I remove this in the second, you know, Duhamel, whatever. I keep expanding, I remove it, I always stay below L2. So what you need to do to solve this problem is you need to remove them, all of them, in the whole Duhamel expansion. Like in the whole expansion, you have to remove them in every single term. So here I try to explain a little bit why the paracontrol doesn't work. So let me skip it because it's too detailed. But the bottom line of this is that you really need to understand the random structure of the remainder, and it's not enough to remove. This is the paraproduct in which you have high frequencies here and low frequencies there. And here I try to explain why this doesn't work. And the whole point of solving it for Schrödinger is that you need to change your point of view and stop thinking that you want to prove a multilinear estimate for this, because you will never be able to prove any multilinear estimate for this that will allow you to close your estimates. It's impossible. So, as I said, because it's not that you have to remove it once or twice, you have to remove it all the time. So you have to somehow shift a little bit the point of view. This is the Duhamel of, high frequencies in the linear evolution of random and low frequencies in the rest of the powers. And what you have to do is you need to think of this term as an operator that sends, say, W here, that sends this into this term. And the whole point of trying to understand the randomness of the remainder is encoded in proving the right estimates for these operators, which are nothing but the correct L2 operator norm estimates and Hilbert-Schmidt norm estimates for that. And if you can prove that, then you change your ansatz to something that looks like this, which is that now your ansatz is the solution plus this, which is what we call, this is an operator. When you sum in all frequencies, the low frequencies are n, and then overall frequencies n, you sum all of this. This is what we call the random averaging operator applied to the linear evolution plus remainder. And this is kind of like removing from all the iterations, from all of them, removing the bad terms. And then after you have done that, then this one can be placed almost close to each one. So then you're fine. Okay. And the way that we prove this is actually we have to do an induction on frequencies. In other words, we have to prove that induction in frequencies, you have to set it up so that if you can prove estimates for the low frequencies, then you can prove estimates for the higher frequencies. So the whole thing goes through an argument, which is an induction on frequencies. And so here is some pictures of what's going on. This is the Duhamel. This is the Duhamel of the. So by this picture, I mean the Duhamel of the cubic term, where this is the linear evolution of random, and these two are the low frequencies of the nonlinear one. And then you expand again. So you have this picture, which is Duhamel. You expand on the first entry here times this. So you have five, and then so on. And the point is that you have to remove all of them. And to remove all of them,
yes.
From the computer.
No, we're doing this for any power. I'm just, thank
How
you.
are you?
I'm doing the picture for the cubic because the picture is hard enough. I don't know how to draw this
No,
picture.
it's a deep
The
shape for the cube.
picture is a cubic, but we do it for any p
Yeah, okay.
bigger or equal than 5. Okay, I just don't know how to.
Not even that is.
I mean, I cannot take any responsibility or claim for any pictures because I didn't do them. They were done by Haitian or by Bjorn or by my student or I don't know, but not by me. So cubic is, yes, go ahead. Yeah, sorry. Okay, so no, this is actually done for quintic and septic, but you know, but it's always the same. You only have high on one and low on all the other ones. And essentially, what you're doing here is because you're doing an induction on frequencies, you are supposed to, by the frequency argument, you're supposed to have information on the low frequencies on this. So when you solve, you're trying to solve a paralinear problem. Where this is essentially given to you is data, okay? And you're suddenly trying to solve for this. And so essentially, your solution, your random averaging operator is nothing but essentially summing all of this. It's this thing that I call like a cube, which is simply the inverse, is the inverse of this operator applied to the linear. And if you go to the Fourier transform, what this operator is a matrix being applied to the Gaussian that corresponds to the linear evolution in high frequencies. This is what we call a 1-1 tensor. It's a matrix that carries all the information of the low frequencies. And these two objects are independent. T here, I'm going to ignore it. It can be taken as a parameter. Okay. And the first person who actually made this observation that you have to be very careful about keeping the independence of these at this was Bjorn in a previous work for the derivative quadratic wave equation, which is a very important idea. All right. So in the end, this is your ansatz, and the way that it works is you start the Gibbs measure is in 2D, it's in 0 minus. This operator you prove that is in H half minus, which is still a supercritical space for the deterministic problem. But the remainder you can make put it almost in H1. And this is the in the Fourier modes, this is how it looks like. Okay. All right, so I'm super late. So nobody's going to ask any questions because I want to take the time. So no questions. All right, so anyway, so this is how we prove, this is what give us the local well-posedness, a probabilistic local well-posedness. And then essentially we use Burgin's globalization to prove that the Gibbs measure, that we have global solutions for data that is in the support of the Gibbs measures in 2D for any power. And what is actually remarkable, I think, is that the decomposition that we get here, this structure of the solution is global. It remains for all times. It's not destroyed. We prove it locally, but then you can actually check that it remains like this for all time. The same as the linear nonlinear of Burgin that is also global. This is global. Okay. So that's actually quite remarkable. Okay, so more generally, how do you reach the full range? Because I'm still in this proof of the random averaging operators, we still started with data here and we took any p. Now what I want is to take any p, any dimension. I don't care anymore about the dimension. I want to take any dimension, any p, and see, say, okay, any p. I wrote it here for p equals to 3. P is larger than 3, this number moves to the right. But okay, let's say, how do you prove it? How do you cover, say, the local well-posedness, the probabilistic local well-posedness in the full subcritical range? You cannot do it just with these random averaging operators. This is where this theory of random tensors that we developed enters. But this theory gives you what it does is it keeps on and peeling off. It keeps on peeling off from the remainder the random structures of this. So we peel it to the first order, but now we can keep on peeling them off to any high order we want, and we know exactly with these random tensors what is the this. We know we can reach the full subcritical where we also know what is the exact detailed information or representation of the solution. So we get a very detailed information on the propagation of randomness. Okay, and this is actually done in full generality. So I'm going to skip this because I'm sure that you're tired. I need a lot of pictures. But this is what it comes for. This is what we call the Q1 tensors. Q measures how many. So these are some examples. So Q measures how many linear evolutions you have in the high frequencies, and one is because you're taking one corresponds to the output frequency, to the K. So this is a 2-1 tensor. So you have two linears going into. So there's always a that one corresponds to the output frequency, okay, to the K. And so you see when you have something like this for a 2-1 tensor, then the 2-1 tensor is more complicated, right? Because now the 2-1 tensor has this structure. But again, you view this as a mapping from K1, K2 into K. And again, you can prove that this carries the information of the low frequencies and that this is independent of this. Okay. And okay, so we develop a theory here. Okay, this is another example. And so we develop a theory that essentially tells us that on the Fourier modes, all the Fourier modes of the solutions can be written, can be expanded in terms of multilinear Gaussians with coefficients, which are our tensors, which are localized in frequency, T is the parameter, and that they remain independent of the Gaussians that you have outside. And we can make the remainder as smooth as you want and as small in L2 as you want. And this is the theory that allows us to cover the full range. And one thing that is very important here is that you see, in each iteration, you gain something of the order, how much regularity you gain from here to here, from here to here, you gain something that is comparable to how far you are from the probabilistic scaling. So if you're far from the probabilistic scaling, so if my scaling was minus a half and I was in zero minus, the random averaging operator is going to gain one half, which is one half minus, which is what we proved. But if I get closer and closer to the probabilistic scaling, then you gain less and less regularity. And so what happens is that you see as you reach the probabilistic scaling, which is your critical problem, you gain nothing and you cannot stop. I can never stop. We can never stop. All right, so this is what happens with the theory. Let me skip all of this. Let me just say something very important that is in this theory. So we have an algebraic part and an analytic part. And and again, the proof goes by an induction on frequency and by induction on the length of the expansion. And the ingredients are the same, are large Gaussian estimates, integer and anticontinuities. And now here we have to put Bourdain's method in steroids. We have to do TT star to very high order to be able to reach the probabilistic scaling. So we have to take TT star many, 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 many times to prove estimates that allow us to reach this. And there is a selection algorithm that exploits the optimizes. You have a choice of estimates and you have to optimize that. So let me skip all of that. And okay, let me just to finish, yes, I have 2 minutes to finish. So talk about this. What happened with the wave? So I discussed all of this. What happened on the wave? On the wave, of course, in 3D, you have the problem that first you are supported in a very rough space, which is a minus a half minus. Now the measure in 3D is not absolutely continuous anymore, respect of your Gaussian. It's singular, which means that you have probabilistic dependent Fourier modes, which is a problem. But on the other hand, for the wave, this is still a subcritical problem because minus a half minus on the wave is still to that side. What is that side, right? To that side of minus three quarters. So it's still subcritical. And this was the only reason why, when we started to work on this problem, we had any faith that we should be able to solve it, because it was still subcritical. Okay. Now, I can explain the proof of this, which has a lot of beautiful ingredients, but let me just mention to finish.